Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 143 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I continue my discussion of Chapter 8 of the Player's Handbook. We'll talk about food and water and interacting with objects. We'll also discuss social interaction and the difference between descriptive and active role-playing. I have some thoughts on how you can encourage more immersive active role-playing from your players. Finally, we'll go over resting and downtime activities. But before we dig into Chapter 8 of the Player's Handbook again, I want to yet again remind you that I have beefed up the $5 Patreon level for patrons of Star Walker Studios. So I went into this in detail last episode, in episode 142, but real quickly, for just $5 a month, you get access to my Patreon feed where you can interact with myself and other patrons. You get access to bonus content, including bloopers and outtakes from the various podcasts I produce. You get access to my special exclusive monthly podcast I do just for the patrons, where I discuss all kinds of nerdy, geeky stuff. And you also get access to the archived episodes of both Game Master's Journey and GM Intrusions. The Game Master's Journey feed has only the most recent episodes in it. So if you want to go all the way back to episode one and hear everything, you can do that as a patron. And you can also check out the precursor podcast, the Game Master's Journey, GM Intrusions, which was a Numenera podcast that was very similar to this podcast, only Numenera exclusive. So patrons get all that. And the cool thing is patrons get their own private RSS feed with all this material in it. So you can subscribe to that just like you subscribe to any podcast using your app of choice and get all of the patron bonus content just like you get all your other podcasts. Pretty sweet. Also, when you become a patron, I will thank you on a future episode of the show. So not only do you get all that for $5 a month, which is about a dollar an episode, but you also get the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping to support this podcast that we all enjoy. Thousands of people listen to this show, but a very small percentage of those people actually become patrons. So you are the elite of the elite. I hope it's obvious that it takes a lot of time and work to produce this show, and it takes money to run the website, and all the time I put into it, well, that costs money too. And, you know, I gotta eat, gotta take care of my family. So everybody that helps out is really appreciated. All right, so that's the end of my Patreon spiel. I hope you will check out my Patreon page. You can find the link at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. You can go check it out. There are additional levels above $5 with even more cool rewards. But I think for just, you know, a dollar an episode, you get a lot of cool stuff. So check it out. Thank you. All right, now we go to food and water. So it says here, characters who don't eat or drink suffer the effects of exhaustion. Exhaustion caused by lack of food or water can't be removed until the character eats and drinks the full required amount. So there's something interesting to know. Food. A character needs 1 pound of food per day and can make food last longer by subsisting on half rations, which would be half a pound a day. Eating half a pound of food in a day counts as half a day without food. A character can go without food for a number of days equal to 3 plus his or her constitution modifier, minimum of 1. So if you have a +2 con bonus, you can go 5 days without food. At the end of each day beyond that limit, a character automatically suffers 1 level of exhaustion. So again, you know, it said just before this that you can do half rations, in which case, I mean, totally makes sense, right? It's considered half a day without food. A normal day of eating resets the count of days without food to 0. So, you know, if you've gone a few days without food, as soon as you have a day where you eat the normal amount, which is a pound of food, then it resets. And if the next day you go out without food, it's considered one day without food. Water. A character needs 1 gallon of water per day. So this is really easy. Like, this is something you can remember and memorize, right? 1 pound of food a day, 1 gallon of water a day. Or 2 gallons per day if the water is hot. That's kind of a funny and weird distinction. Why would you be drinking hot water? I don't know. I guess if you're drinking a lot of tea, you have to drink twice as much. A character who drinks only half that much water must succeed on a DC 15 constitution saving throw or suffer 1 level of exhaustion at the end of the day. A character with access to even less water, so less than half a gallon per day, automatically suffers 1 level of exhaustion at the end of the day. If the character already has 1 or more levels of exhaustion, the character takes 2 levels in either case. And keep in mind that these would add together. So if you have a character who is going without food and water, those levels of exhaustion that they get from going without food and the levels of exhaustion they get from going without water would add together. So, you know, you could go downhill pretty quick. All right, so now we have a short discussion on interacting with objects. You know, it says that for the most part, when PCs interact with objects, you know, the player just tells the DM what they want to do and the DM tells them what happens. For instance, they want to pull a lever or whatever. However, there are some specifics here. So it talks about damaging objects with weapons or spells. Objects are immune to poison and psychic damage, which totally makes sense when you think about it. But otherwise, they can be affected by physical and magical attacks, much like creatures can. As a DM, you would determine the armor class and hit points of the object, and you might decide that certain objects have resistance or immunity to certain kinds of attacks. For instance, it's hard to cut a rope with a club. So if you had a situation where it's in the middle of a combat and for some reason a player character needs to cut through a rope and they're trying to use a club for some reason, you could say that it's either resistant to that damage, which means it's taking half the damage from the club, or you could say it's completely immune to it. I'd probably say it's immune to it. I can't imagine you clubbing your way through a rope. Objects always fail strength and dexterity saving throws, and they are immune to effects that require other saves. When an object drops to 0 hit points, it breaks. Again, we'll discuss this more in the DMG, but I will tell you that in the DMG, there is a table that gives sample materials and what their armor class and hit points would be. So if you're in a situation as a DM running the game where you need to worry about objects taking damage, you can check out that table and it'll be pretty easy to figure out how to work that out. A character can also attempt a strength check to break an object. The DM sets the DC for any such check. And again, I think that table in the DMG also gives DCs to break certain kinds of objects. Next, we go into social interaction. So here we talk a little bit about NPCs' attitudes, which is just, you know, when the player characters are dealing with an NPC socially, kind of what is that NPC's attitude towards the PCs? And this is simplified down to say that NPCs can have an attitude of either friendly, indifferent, or hostile. Friendly NPCs are predisposed to help you, and hostile ones are inclined to get in your way. It's easier to get what you want from a friendly NPC than a hostile or even an indifferent one. Makes sense, right? So social interactions in the game have 2 primary aspects, role-playing and ability checks. So we'll go into role-playing a bit. So role-playing is literally what the word says, playing a role. In this case, you, the player, are playing the role of your character. So it goes on to define the 2 basic styles of role-playing, descriptive and active, and says that most players use a combination of the two. So descriptive role-playing is where you describe your player's words and actions to the Dungeon Master and the other players. You tell everyone what your character does and what your character says. So here's an example. Chris plays Tordek the Dwarf. Tordek has a quick temper and blames the elves of the Cloakwood for his family's misfortune. At a tavern, an obnoxious elf minstrel sits at Tordek's table and tries to strike up a conversation with the dwarf. Chris says, Tordek spits on the floor, growls an insult at the bard, and stomps over to the bar. He sits on a stool and glares at the minstrel before ordering another drink. In this example, Chris has conveyed Tordek's mood and given the DM a clear idea of his character's attitude and actions. So when you're using descriptive roleplaying, you can keep the following things in mind. Describe your character's emotions and attitude. Focus on your character's intent and how others might perceive it. Provide as much embellishment as you feel comfortable with. Don't worry about getting things exactly right. Just focus on thinking about what your character would do and describing what you see in your mind. Next, we have the active approach to roleplaying. If descriptive roleplaying tells your DM and your fellow players what your character thinks and does, active roleplaying shows them. When you use active roleplaying, you speak with your character's voice like an actor playing a role. You might even echo your character's movements and body language. This approach is more immersive than descriptive roleplaying, though you still need to describe things that can't be reasonably acted out. Going back to the example we just used of Chris playing Tordek the dwarf, here's how that scene might play out if Chris used active roleplaying. Speaking as Tordek, Chris says in a gruff, deep voice,
I was wondering why it suddenly smelled awful in here. If I wanted to hear anything out of you, I'd snap your arm and enjoy your screams.
In his normal voice, Chris then adds, I get up, glare at the elf, and head to the bar. So these are the two main ways that we roleplay. And I will point out, this is Player's Handbook, so we're talking about players here, but the GM does the same thing, right? As a GM, you use descriptive and active roleplaying. And you need both. Many of us, I think, prefer active roleplaying because, as it says here, it's more immersive. It's more immersive. I just keep thinking of different ways to say the same thing, but it's more immersive. It's more fun. It's more, you get more into it. It's more entertaining for everybody involved if people are speaking in character instead of telling us in a descriptive way what the character is saying. However, you can't do everything actively, even as a player, because there are going to be things that you're going to have to describe that you can't act out. So all of us use, or most of us probably, use a combination of the two, whether we're players or GMs. Now, there might be players out there, and there are players out there, who only do descriptive role-playing and never do active role-playing, and that's okay. Especially with newer players, that's okay. If you have players who never do active role-playing, who always do descriptive role-playing, I would encourage them to do more active role-playing. Now, if they're brand new players, don't worry about it. Let them learn the game. Let them get comfortable. You need to, as a GM, be able to gauge your player's comfort level, right? You'll know, okay? You can tell with a new player that, they're a little awkward. They feel a little weird, playing pretend in front of their friends as adults. And, it's a little awkward for them. And if you're sensing that awkwardness still, I wouldn't worry about trying to get them to active role play more. Just let them do what they're comfortable with. But you'll be able to tell as a GM when a player is ready to take that next step. Okay, and if you think a player is ready, then encourage them to active role play. And the best way I think to do this is to wait for a moment or moments when the player's character is trying to influence an NPC. For instance, let's say they've come to a town, it's after dark, the gates are shut. The guards, as a rule, don't open the gates for people after dark. So the players come up to the gate, they want to get into the town, and the guards say, sorry, you'll have to come back in the morning. We don't open the gates after dark. But the player characters, for whatever reason, really want to get into the town now. Maybe there's goblins out there and they don't want to deal with them or whatever. So one of the players says, well, I'm going to try to convince the guard to let us in, right? Now, of course, you can call for a social check here, and I would. But usually what a GM will do before calling for the check is say, well, what do you say to the guard? So the player might do descriptive role playing and say, oh, I'm going to tell him that, you know, we've traveled long and we're tired and, you know, we're law-abiding citizens and we won't cause any troubles. And maybe even I'll offer to slip him a gold if he'll open the gate for us. So that's descriptive. The player is describing what their character does and says. He's not saying it in character, right? So if this is a player that always does descriptive role playing and you think they're ready, this is a great time to say, okay, that's cool, but before I have you make a check, I want you to actually tell me in character, in your character's voice, exactly what you say to the guard. And depending on what you say and how you say it, that will help me determine how difficult this check is going to be for you. And I would not, again, you know, this is a player that you're trying to coax out of their shell a little bit. You're trying to get them to active role play instead of descriptive role play. So I would not penalize or punish the player in any way. I would, before they even start their spiel, I would say, okay, it's going to be a DC 15 persuasion check, charisma persuasion check, to convince this guard to open the gate. Okay. If the player doesn't do a great job of being convincing to the guard, then it's DC 15. That's the difficulty I decided it was. The player, I'm not going to let the player hurt themselves by getting into character. If, however, I think the player does a halfway decent job of role-playing being convincing to the guard, then maybe the DC becomes 10 instead of 15, or maybe 5, or maybe if I think the player does a good job, they just succeed without a role. Again, you know, you have to think about what are you trying to accomplish as a game master. If I have a character who's fairly new to role playing, or a player, I'm sorry, who's fairly new to role playing, hasn't done any active role playing yet, and I'm giving this opportunity and saying, hey, if you do this actively, if you speak in your character's voice, it may reduce the difficulty of the check, increase your odds of success, or if you do well enough, you may just succeed and not have to make a roll at all. You know, my goal here is to get the player out of his shell because I want to see more active role playing out of this player because it's going to make it more fun for everybody involved if the players actively role play more. So since that's my goal, first of all, there's not going to be any penalty. If the player does a terrible job at actively role playing, it's not going to make the role harder than it would have been otherwise. And I would let the player know, like if that happened, I'd say, okay, I appreciate the effort. You did a fine job, but it wasn't good enough to make the role easier, but it wasn't bad enough to make the role harder. Like I would let the player know you haven't been penalized because the player probably knows that, wow, that didn't go really well, right? And I would also set my standards pretty low for what I expect from the player in order to reduce the difficulty of that role. Because again, I want to encourage the player to try this new thing. And it's always awkward to try a new thing. And it's really easy to be discouraged when you're trying something new that's awkward. So if I do anything remotely discouraging, it's likely the player isn't going to try actively role-playing again anytime soon, right? So I'd set the bar pretty low for the player to be able to reduce that difficulty. And I'd also set it lower than I normally would for them to do well enough to not require a role. Because let's say maybe the character doesn't have a great charisma and doesn't have persuasion. So if the player has to make a roll for this, they're going to have to roll a 15 without any bonuses, say, or maybe even with a penalty. But if the player role plays it at all actively and does, you know, tries, honestly, I would just want them to try, then maybe they succeed without a roll. That's a pretty big reward for that player because they know that their chances were not good to succeed at rolling a 15 with no bonus, right? It's not very good odds, but if they just try to role play a little bit and I let them succeed without a role, that I just encourage them to active role play more. So always use carrots and not sticks when you can. Now with this particular player, as time goes on and they get more comfortable with the active role playing, then I would, you know, I would stop softballing so much. You know what I mean? You know, I would set that bar a little bit higher after a while, after they get more comfortable. And again, you have to do this on a player-to-player basis. You know, you might have one player in the party who is a thespian and is really good at the active role playing. So, you know, you're not going to, you know, give them any breaks when it comes to, you know, whether or not you let them automatically succeed or get a bonus or advantage or something on their role because they role played well, because this character isn't stretching them, or this player isn't stretching themselves at all. Right. But then you have another player that never actively role plays. If they try at all, maybe they just succeed, or maybe they get advantage on their role or something like that. Or maybe the DC is 5 instead of 15. Right. Again, to encourage them to do this more, because it's going to make the game more fun for them. It's going to make the game more fun for the other players, and it's going to make the game more fun for you as a GM if you can get them to actively roleplay. And that's a thing too, is, you know, if you do have that thespian player in the group who's really good, and maybe they can do accents, and maybe their character has a very distinct voice, and maybe they act things out, you know, if you hold the other players to that same standard that you do that character who's really good at it, they're not going to active role play because they know that they're never going to do as good as the actor player does. Right. So you kind of grade each player based on where they're at. Right. And let the players know, look, you know, John over here is literally an actor in real life. He can do accents. He can do different voices, and, you know, he's really good at it. I don't expect you guys to do as well as he does. You know, I'm going to give you guys more breaks than I give John when it comes to the role playing, because you guys are stretching yourselves a lot more than John is, right? Just try to be fair. All right, so now results of role-playing. The DM uses your character's actions and attitudes to determine how an NPC reacts. A cowardly NPC buckles under threats of violence. A stubborn dwarf refuses to let anyone badger her. A vain dragon laps up flattery. Players, when interacting with an NPC, pay close attention to the DM's portrayal of the NPC's mood, dialogue, and personality. So DMs, you don't need to tell your players if they're friendly, indifferent, or hostile. You know, it's perfectly fine to make them figure that out by how you're role-playing that NPC. So it says you might be able to determine an NPC's personality traits, ideals, flaws, and bonds, then play on them to influence the NPC's attitude. Interactions in D&D are much like interactions in real life, and the more like them you can make it to real life, the better. If you can offer NPCs something they want, threaten them with something they fear, or play on their sympathies and goals, you can use words to get almost anything you want. On the other hand, if you insult a proud warrior or speak ill of nobles' allies, your efforts to convince or deceive them will fall short. And this is a great time to leverage the advantage and disadvantage mechanic. So if you have a player actively role-playing with an NPC and they play to that NPC's ego or something like that, then maybe they get advantage on the check. Similarly, if they insult the NPC, whether on purpose or not, maybe it gives them disadvantage. In addition to role-playing, ability checks are key in determining the outcome of an interaction. Your role-playing efforts can alter an NPC's attitude, but there might still be an element of chance in the situation. Also, it could be that your character's abilities are very different from your abilities as a player. So maybe you're playing a super charismatic, persuasive character, and you're not that person in real life. So that's when, you know, the checks can come in handy. But you can still use your role-playing to enhance that check. So maybe if you role-play really well, you get advantage. Pay attention to your skill proficiencies when thinking of how you want to interact with an NPC. And stack the deck in your favor by using the approach that relies on your best bonuses and skills. And this isn't metagame at all. We all know what our strengths and weaknesses are, and we tend to rely on our strengths as much as we can. If the group needs to trick a guard into letting them into a castle, the rogue who is proficient in deception is the best bet to lead the discussion. When negotiating for a hostage's release, the cleric with persuasion should do most of the talking. Just makes sense, right? So as a DM, I would just recommend that you encourage role-playing, that you encourage active role-playing as the player's comfort level gets to the point where they're ready to branch out into that, and that you allow role-playing to augment or possibly hamper the social roles that the players make. Role-playing can be a great way for a player to mitigate the fact that their social bonuses aren't that great. So maybe they get a lower difficulty or they get advantage on the role from good role-playing. And also their bonuses that they can use on rolls can help when you have a character who's especially good at a social thing that the player isn't that great at, but you can still bring how well they're role-playing the interaction into that role.
This is Shane from the Total Party Thrill podcast, and you're listening to Lex Starwalker on Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve. Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, so now we go into resting. So in 5th edition, we have two different kinds of resting in the game, the short rest and the long rest. The short rest is a period of downtime, at least an hour long, during which a character does nothing more strenuous than eating, drinking, reading, and tending to wounds. A character can spend one or more hit dice at the end of a short rest, up to the character's maximum number of hit dice, which is equal to the character's level. For each hit die spent in this way, the player rolls a die and adds the character's constitution modifier to it. The character regains hit points equal to the total. The player can decide to spend an additional hit die after each roll. The character regains some spent hit die dice upon finishing a long rest as described below. So, you know, that's an important point here. As a player, when you take a short rest, you don't have to decide ahead of time how many of your hit dice you're going to use. You can roll them one at a time and see how you do, which is pretty sweet. So again, short rest, at least an hour long. It can be longer, and you can't do anything more strenuous than eating, drinking, reading, and tending to wounds. And then at the end of that time, you get to roll hit dice to recover hit points. And then some classes will have abilities that will recharge after a short rest. And if that's the case, the ability will say so. Then we have the long rest. A long rest is a period of extended downtime, at least 8 hours long. Could be longer, but at least 8 hours. During this time, a character sleeps or performs light activity, reading, talking, eating, or standing watch for no more than 2 hours. So the way the commas work here, the way grammar works, the more than 2 hours is referring to standing watch. So you can read, talk, and eat as long as you want during a long rest. The 2 hours is standing watch. So if you stand watch for longer than 2 hours, you're not going to get a long rest. If the rest is interrupted by a period of strenuous activity, for instance, at least an hour of walking, fighting, casting spells, or similar adventuring activity, the characters must begin the rest again to gain any benefit from it. So, you know, this is a classic scenario. The player characters are out in the wilderness somewhere. They decide to take a long rest. They're taking turns, taking watch. Again, the total rest for the entire party can be just 8 hours, as long as each PC's watch is not longer than 2 hours. They'll still get the benefit of the long rest. But if during that 8 hour period that the party is resting, if they get attacked and they have to fight, it does not interrupt their long rest or count against it as long as it doesn't take more than an hour, which, you know, very few, if any, combats in D&D are going to last an hour. An hour would be like 600 rounds. I don't think any combat in the history of D&D has gone 600 rounds. Probably one has somewhere, but I've never had one that go that long, thank God. That would take months to play through. So yeah, you know, that's pretty sweet, and it's much more forgiving than some previous editions, how they handled rests. So, you know, you can take your long rest, and during that long rest, you can stand watch for 2 hours.
And during that long rest, you could have a combat as long as it isn't an hour or more. And you could have multiple combats as long as they don't add up to an hour or more. Now, corner case here, elves. Elves don't sleep. Instead, they go into a trance. And when you read about the elves in the Player's Handbook, if you're going to make an elven character, that trance only needs to be 4 hours. That does not mean that your long rest only needs to be 4 hours. That has nothing to do with the long rest rules. You notice here, it doesn't say anything about elves. Everyone needs 8 hours for a long rest. It's just that as an elf, only 4 of that 8 hours needs to be doing the trance. The other 4 hours, you can be doing these other non-strenuous activities like talking, reading, eating, etc. And you can still only spend 2 hours of that on watch. So if you're an elf, you can't, you know, do trance for 4 hours and then be on watch for the other 4 hours, because that's more than 2 hours on watch and you won't get the benefit of a long rest. So I often see players asking about that. Oh, since I'm an elf, do I only need 4 hours for a long rest? Nope, you still need 8 hours. It's just you get to spend more of that time doing things like reading or, you know, doing something relaxing, and less of it has to be spent in your trance. At the end of a long rest, a character regains all lost hit points. The character also regains spent hit dice up to a number equal to half the character's total number of them. And yeah, it actually doesn't clarify here. It might be in the errata, but at first level, you regain 1 hit die at the end of a long rest. So normally, you know, the general rule is anytime you have a fraction, you round down. So, you know, this is saying you get half your level worth of hit dice back in a long rest, and half of 1 would be 1/2, and you round it down to 0. But at first level, you do get 1 hit die back at the end of a long rest. So again, these are referring to hit dice that you spend for healing during a short rest. So once you're past first level, let's say you're 4th level, you have 4 hit dice that you can use for healing during a short rest. At the end of a long rest, you can get up to 2 of those spent hit dice back because it's half your level. A character can't benefit from more than 1 long rest in a 24-hour period, and a character must have at least 1 hit point at the start of the rest to gain its benefits. So if your character is unconscious with 0 hit points and you're out for 8 hours, you don't get the benefit of a long rest because you have to have at least 1 hit point to get the benefit of a long rest. So yeah, those rules are pretty straightforward, pretty cut and dry, and very forgiving. Especially compared to some previous editions of the game, because if you get attacked in the middle of your long rest, it's not going to interrupt your rest. And, you know, you don't have to rest longer than the 8 hours to account for the fact that you're taking turns on watch, as long as your shift on watch isn't more than 2 hours. All right, so now we go to Between Adventures. Between trips to dungeons and battles against ancient evils, adventurers need time to rest, recuperate, and prepare for their next adventure. Many adventurers also use this time to perform other tasks, such as crafting arms and armor, performing research, or spending their hard-earned gold. In some cases, the passage of time is something that occurs with little fanfare or description. When starting a new adventure, the DM might simply declare that a certain amount of time has passed and allow you to describe in general terms what your character has been doing. At other times, the DM might want to keep track of just how much time is passing as events beyond your perception stay in motion. So, you know, this is a call that you make as a GM when you're going to have some downtime between one adventure and the next. Does it matter how much time that is exactly and what the characters are doing every day of that time? So now we talk about lifestyle expenses. Between adventures, you choose a particular quality of life and pay the cost of maintaining that lifestyle as described in Chapter 5. And we discussed this earlier on the show when we were talking about Chapter 5, which is the chapter on equipment. Living a particular lifestyle doesn't have a huge effect on your character, but your lifestyle can affect the way other individuals and groups react to you. For example, when you lead an aristocratic lifestyle, it might be easier for you to influence the nobles of the city than if you live in poverty. Downtime activities. So this is something really cool in 5th edition that I'm a big fan of, these downtime activities. And I will tell you, there's a very short discussion of this here in the Player's Handbook. There is more information about downtime activities, as well as more examples of downtime activities and how they work in the Dungeon Master's Guide. Between adventures, the DM might ask you what your character is doing during his or her downtime. Again, downtime is just time in between one adventure to the other that we're not going to role play through. That could be a few days, it could be weeks, months, years, decades, even centuries if you have long-lived player characters. Periods in downtime can vary in duration, but each downtime activity requires a certain number of days to complete before you gain any benefit, and at least 8 hours of each day must be spent on the downtime activity for the day to count. The days do not need to be consecutive. If you have more than the minimum amount of days to spend, you can keep doing the same thing for a longer period of time or switch to a new downtime activity. Again, really straightforward and logical. Downtime activities other than the ones presented below are possible. If you want your character to spend his or her downtime performing an activity not covered here, discuss it with your DM. And again, there are more downtime activities in the DMG. So we have crafting. You can craft non-magical objects, including adventuring equipment and works of art. You must be proficient with tools related to the object you are trying to create, typically artisan's tools of some kind. You might also need access to special materials or locations necessary to create it. For example, someone proficient with smith's tools needs a forge in order to craft a sword or suit of armor. For every day of downtime you spend crafting, you can craft one or more items with a total market value not exceeding 5 gold pieces. So you could craft one item worth 5 gold or 5 items worth 1 gold, for example, in a single day, which would be 8 hours of that day spent crafting. And you must expend raw materials worth half the total market value. So if you're crafting a dagger, which I believe has a market value of 1 gold. You could do that easily in a day because you can do up to 5 gold worth of market value in a day. So you could actually craft 2 daggers in a day. And each of those daggers would cost you 1 gold, half the value in materials. If something you want to craft has a market value greater than 5 gold pieces, you make progress every day in 5 gold piece increments until you reach the market value of the item. For example, a suit of plate armor, market value 1,500 gold, takes 300 days to craft by yourself. So again, you would just take 1,500 gold, divide by 5 gold, and that's 300 days. Multiple characters can combine their efforts toward the crafting of a single item, provided that the characters all have proficiency with the requisite tools and are working together in the same place. Each character contributes 5 gold pieces worth of effort for every day spent helping to craft the item. For example, 3 characters with the requisite tool proficiency and the proper facilities can craft a suit of plate armor in 100 days at a total cost of 750 gold pieces. So again, taking this example, we have a suit of full plate armor, market value 1,500 gold, takes 300 days to craft. So 300 man days. You know, we're familiar with the term man hours, right? Sorry, it's sexist. Human hours, that's what we should call it. So 300 human days. So if you have 3 people working on it, then that would take you 100 days if they're all working on it the whole time, right? 300 days total divided by 3 people is 100 days. And then the cost is half the market value. So half of 1,500 gold is 750 gold is what it would cost you in materials to make that suit of armor. While crafting, you can maintain a modest lifestyle without having to pay 1 gold per day or a comfortable lifestyle at half the normal cost. See Chapter 5 for more information on lifestyle expenses. And again, we talked about this on the show when we were talking about Chapter 5 equipment. I went through the different lifestyle expenses. So, you know, basically, if you're crafting something using this downtime activity, then during the time that you spend crafting, you can have the modest lifestyle at no cost. You know, that's covered in the cost of the crafting. Or you could have the comfortable lifestyle at half the normal cost. So that's pretty cool. Another downtime activity is practicing a profession. You can work between adventures, allowing you to maintain a modest lifestyle without having to pay the one gold piece cost per day. So again, just like with the crafting, if you're practicing your profession during downtime, each day that you do that, you can have the modest lifestyle at no additional cost. This benefit lasts as long as you continue to practice your profession. If you are a member of an organization that can provide gainful employment, such as a temple or a thieves guild, you earn enough to support a comfortable lifestyle instead. So that's a step up in your lifestyle that you can have for free if you're practicing your profession. If you have proficiency in the performance skill and put your performance skill to use during your downtime, you earn enough to support a wealthy lifestyle instead. So bards or anyone else that has proficiency in performance during your downtime, you can practice that profession. And each day that you do that, you can live a wealthy lifestyle and not have to pay anything for it, which is pretty sweet. Now, you could get more granular with this, GMs, if you wanted to. And I would. It's not super difficult to do. So let's flip back to chapter 5. Let's look at our lifestyle expenses here in chapter 5. And we will use the performer as our example. So let's say we have a bard PC. We have some downtime. And this player character is going to spend that downtime performing and practicing a profession as a performer. So this tells us that using performance, you can maintain a wealthy lifestyle instead, which a wealthy lifestyle, if you were going to pay for that, costs you 4 gold per day, okay? So let's say our player says, all right, my bard character, we've got a month of downtime. I'm going to practice my profession of being a bard, of performing for people every day for 8 hours a day. That's a lot of performing, guys. Oh, my God. But anyway, so that might be something I might get a little more noodly there. And I might say, you know, if you're going to perform 8 hours a day, you're probably performing at numerous different taverns and inns and whatnot across the city. You know, maybe 2 hours here, 2 hours there, 2 hours there. It might be hard to perform 8 hours a day. Yeah, you could do it if you really wanted to. So it might be more realistic to say, well, you're only performing 2 or 4 hours a day. So maybe it takes, you know, 2 days of your downtime if you're performing 4 hours a day to equal, you know, again, you can get as noodly with this if you want. But let's say the character's performing 8 hours a day, okay? So the player's like, okay, if I perform 8 hours a day, I get a wealthy lifestyle for free, which is worth 4 gold a day. Like that's what I would pay for the wealthy lifestyle for 4 gold a day. But the player says, you know, I look at the comfortable lifestyle, which costs 2 gold per day. Can my character, instead of living the wealthy lifestyle, 4 gold per day for free, could I say, well, I'm not going to live large like that. I'm going to do the comfortable lifestyle instead. And can I net 2 gold per day? And I would allow that. So I'd say, you know, okay, normally with this downtime activity of performing as a profession, you could have a wealthy lifestyle day, which would normally cost you 4 gold per day. But if you want to instead live the comfortable lifestyle, you're saving money, basically, right? You know, you're not spending all the money you're making performing on luxuries. You're instead spending half of it for living expenses and saving the other half. So I would probably let that fly and say, yeah, you can live the comfortable lifestyle instead and bag 2 gold per day. But you might not want to do that as a GM, and you don't have to, you know, that would be a house rule. And, you know, it might be a thing where sometimes I would let the player do that and sometimes not, because it could be a thing of maybe I decide as a GM that they really need that wealthy lifestyle in order to be able to perform and do well performing. You know, maybe they need to keep up appearances or something like that. Or maybe the player characters already have enough gold, and I don't really want this player, you know, netting 2 gold every day of downtime, because again, you know, that's not explicitly in the rules that they can do that. So I might not allow them to do that. It would depend on the situation, but I'm just using this as an example of how, you know, these rules give you kind of this loose framework, and you can drill down further into them if you want and kind of come up with subsystems that still fit in the structure of the rule and aren't changing anything, but getting a little more nuanced if you want to. Another downtime activity described here is recuperating. You can use downtime between adventures to recover from a debilitating injury, disease, or poison. After 3 days of downtime spent recuperating, you can make a DC 15 Constitution saving throw, and on a successful save, you can choose one of the following results. So you could end one effect on you that prevents you from regaining hit points. Or, for the next 24 hours, you gain advantage on saving throws against one disease or poison currently affecting you. So maybe your character has a disease and, you know, you can't shake it. So you spend 3 days recuperating, and then you can make your save against that disease with advantage. Another downtime activity is researching. The time between adventures is a great chance to perform research, gaining insight into mysteries that have unfurled over the course of the campaign. This is something I see players do a lot. It's a great downtime activity. Research can include poring over dusty tomes and crumbling scrolls in a library, or buying drinks for the locals to pry rumors and gossip from their lips. So, you know, one's kind of the wizard intelligence-based research, and the other's the bard kind of charisma, gathering gossip and rumors kind of research. Really cool stuff. When you begin your research, the DM determines whether the information is available. So again, the rules don't let you do the impossible. You as DM get to decide, is this even something that can be researched, or is this information even available? So the DM determines whether the information is available, how many days of downtime it will take to find it, and whether there are any restrictions on your research, such as needing to seek out a specific individual, tome, or location. The DM might also require you to make one or more ability checks, such as an intelligence investigation check to find clues pointing toward the information you seek, or a charisma persuasion check to secure someone's aid. Once those conditions are met, you learn the information if it is available. For each day of research, you must spend 1 gold to cover your expenses. This cost is in addition to your normal lifestyle expenses, as described in Chapter 5. So, you know, this is one where it's going to cost you more to do this downtime activity on top of your lifestyle expenses. And the last downtime activity described here in the Player's Handbook is training. You can spend time between adventures learning a new language or training with a set of tools. Your DM might allow additional training options. First, you must find an instructor willing to teach you. The DM determines how long it takes and whether one or more ability checks are required. The training lasts for 250 days and costs 1 gold per day. After you spend the requisite amount of time and money, you learn the new language or gain proficiency with the new tool. So that's super cool. That's a great thing to do, especially if you're going to have extensive amounts of downtime. But remember, it said earlier in here that you don't have to do this all at once. So even if you're not taking 250 days of downtime between two adventures, you know, you can do a little here, a little there, and eventually accumulate that 250 days and learn the new language or learn to use the new tool. I will tell you that some of the possibilities in the DMG include, you could possibly, this is an optional rule, but as a DM, you could let player characters learn feats in this way, which is pretty cool. So you can have them learn a feat. And again, they would have to find someone that can teach them that feat and then spend the gold and spend the time to learn it. But that's pretty sweet, I think. And there we go. That is the end of Chapter 8. So lots of good stuff in this chapter, and hopefully going through this, I've uncovered some things that maybe you missed or forgot or overlooked. And yeah, hopefully this will help you in your game.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up episode 143 of Game Master's Journey. Thank you for joining me today and going through the Player's Handbook with me. Really enjoying this series of episodes and really looking forward to getting to the DMG. We're spending a lot more time in the Player's Handbook than I thought we would, but there's just a lot more material in there for DMs than I realized. So it's time well spent, I think. So I encourage you to visit my website, starwalkerstudios.com. Check out the show notes for this and all the Game Master's Journey episodes, and you can find a lot of great ways to get a hold of me at starwalkerstudios.com. You can email me, follow me on Twitter, Google+, Facebook. I also have a Pinterest where I collect inspiring fantasy and science fiction art. You can find a link to my YouTube channel where I've got actual play videos. You can find the Game Master's Journey voicemail number where you can call and leave me a message. And if your question or feedback on the show is entertaining or enlightening, you might even hear yourself on the show. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. And finally, again, at starwalkerstudios.com, you can find a link to my Patreon page where you can become a patron. There are other ways that you can support the show on the support page at starwalkerstudios.com. I have a donate button if you'd prefer to make a one-time donation. And I also have an Amazon referral link that you can click to take you to Amazon. Do all your regular shopping that you do on Amazon. Won't cost you any more money, but it will help me out greatly. So you can find all this and more at starwalkerstudios.com. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.